business. In the settlement announced today, Wells will pay $500 million to the Office of Comptroller of Currency and $500 million to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And finally, mourners are continuing to line up at St. Martin's Episcopal Church in Houston, Texas, where they are paying their final respects to former First Lady Barbara Bush. This is USA Radio News.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Are drug and alcohol problems hitting you too close to home? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. 866-490-3991. 866-490-3991. That's 866-490-3991.
The public can pay their last respects to First Lady Barbara Bush in Houston today. Dana Perino was George W. Bush's press secretary. She is down in Houston and talks about some of the things that we're finding out in the last months before Mrs. Bush passed away.
One of the things that she did in the last several years is she had a lot of input as to how this should go. She knew that this day would come, of course, and she wanted to make it easier on everybody by making sure that she knew, that we all knew exactly what she wanted in her arrangements, the songs, the spirit of it. She did not want it to be called a funeral. She was very specific, making sure it was called a celebration of life. And Bill, I think for me, especially since we knew last Sunday that she had decided to refuse medical treatment, that it's been kind of a whirlwind, you know, getting the coverage done, making sure we tell the story. And tomorrow morning at that celebration of life, the funeral, I think that's when everybody can take a moment just to be quiet and maybe also just to be a little more sad and feel those emotions. But then she's going to want everybody to move on and live their lives.
Mrs. Bush's body will lie in repose until midnight Central Time at St. Martin's Episcopal Church. The invitation-only funeral is scheduled for tomorrow, and former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and current First Lady Melania Trump are all expected to attend. For USA Radio News, my name is Tim Berg.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hunterdon Chamber Radio entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon. It's Friday, April 20th, a few minutes after 4 o'clock. And, of course, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the news before we go on to the program, It's the Law. And did I say news? I really meant weather. You've just heard the news. So what's happening? Well, make sure that you don't have anything outside that could freeze tonight, because it could be 31 degrees and it's going to be mostly clear. So that makes the ground, often makes it colder on the ground, especially since there's still a lot of, we've had a lot of humidity as far as the rain. So that can be something to walk, when you walk, watch if you're walking on a wooden deck or something else that could be slippery. And, of course, be careful that there's not patches of ice, both on the roads, although probably not because it's been warm today. So tomorrow we're going to have should be mostly sunny, beautiful day, 58 degrees. So it looks like at least it's starting to warm up. Today, of course, was really, although it said it was 50 degrees, it did seem actually warmer than that. by tomorrow night, again, right around freezing. Lows expected about 34 degrees. Again, mostly clear tomorrow night. Sunday, it looks like it's going to be a beautiful sunny day, 61 degrees. So it's time that we can go outside and start working because it's cool enough that, but not too cold. So by Sunday night, again, mostly clear, low of around 36 degrees. Monday, sunny, high expected around 64 degrees, and then mostly cloudy on Monday night. And again, partly cloudy on Tuesday, but you never know. It's hard to predict sometimes in a day in advance. Okay, so the program, It's the Law. And let me just play a couple spots, and then we'll be back.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Okay, we're back, and I'm Pat Smits. Those of you who know I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County. I'm an attorney. My practice is just family law, but rather than talk about family law all the time, I like to talk about some of the latest news articles with respect to the law, some of the cases, and I think that there was certainly a case of real importance. This week is a decision by the Supreme Court of New Jersey with respect to whether or not grants to a church violate the New Jersey Supreme Court Constitution. And in fact, this what this case involved was that there was an award of $4.6 million in taxpayer funds by Morris County to churches. And there was a challenge to that, and the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that it violated the religious aid clause of the state constitution. And because the grants to the churches were not for something other than, well, I should say they were not totally for something other than church, renovating churches, historical churches that were still used for church services. So this wasn't a building owned by a church that was going to be used for a public purpose. I also want to congratulate my friend, Jane Altman, and she received the Tischler Award for Excellence in Family Law. That was a well-deserved award by someone who's been practicing about the same amount of time that I've been practicing. And that is an award presented each year to a person for lifetime contributions to the advancement of family law. And Jane has also served for many years on the advisory board of Women's Space, the Mercer County Shelter for Battered Women. And as I said, Jane is in a small firm in the Princeton area. So it's not one of the, sometimes we wonder about some of these awards, but not in this case. A federal judge has rejected the approval of a class action settlement that drew an unusual objection from the U.S. Justice Department, but then it withdrew that. So, I may talk more about that, but probably not. There's also a bill to end double taxation of certain attorneys' fees so that a bill that was drafted by the New Jersey State Bar Association meant to end the double taxation of attorneys' fees and costs received in connection with certain unlawful discrimination and unlawful retaliation cases or claims or actions passed the Senate earlier this month. And so this, so people will not be taxed twice, and that's what's important in that case. So There was a appellate division case that was approved for publication, and this was the defendant appealed from his judgment of conviction and from the denial of his motion for modification of his sentence. And what happened here, the court agreed that the trial court failed to state the factual and legal basis for applying aggregating factors and imposed an unauthorized sentence on endangering the welfare of a child charge. So what happened here is the police had identified the defendant as having made child pornography available for download on the internet. I mean, one caution, if you know anyone who is viewing child pornography on the internet, they must stop immediately. And there's a question of whether or not you'd have to report them. But in any event, this is really is being prosecuted. And not a lot of leniency and not a lot of understanding from prosecutors when these cases are brought. But this was based on the files found on his computer, and his initials are ATC. This was State versus ATC, an appellate division decision, and so they do not identify the defendant. But based on the files found on his computer and his admission to the police, the defendant was charged with possession and distribution of child pornography. The police interviewed the minor daughter of the defendant's girlfriend, who disclosed that the defendant had sexually abused her. And so he pled guilty to sexual assault of a child and endangering the welfare of a child by distribution of child pornography in exchange for a recommended sentence of 20 years without parole. Now, defendant was recommended for sentencing under the Sex Offenders Act, given his compulsive behavior and need for sex offender treatment. So after the sentencing, the defendant moved to modify the recommendation or the recommended term in favor of the ordinary range of 10 to 20 years, subject to parole inability. Ineligibility period. So what he agreed to was a 20-year sentence without parole instead of the range, which is usually 10 to 20 years, subject to a certain parole ineligibility. So that means that if he was sentenced for 10 years, it could be also 10 years parole ineligibility. So that the trial court denied his motion, ruling that the amendments, and this was amendments to the Jessica Lunsford Act applied to the defendant despite the subsequent effective date. And the sentence, the trial judge sentenced the defendant according to the plea agreement, in other words, 20 years without parole. On appeal, the defendant challenged the applicability of the act called the Jessica Lunsford Act, and argued that it was a violation of separation of powers. Defendant further argued that the trial court erred in its determination of aggravating and mitigating factors. So the court affirmed the defendant's conviction, but remanded for resentencing. The court ruled that the legislature intended the act, the JLA Act, to remain effective following subsequent amendment, and rejecting the defendant's assertion of ambiguity, requiring the application of the rule of lenity, I guess they call it, or violation of the separation of powers, as the trial court retained ultimate authority over sentencing. However, the appellate court, as I said, agreed that the trial court failed to state the factual and legal basis for applying aggregating factors, and therefore imposed an unauthorized sentence on the endangering of the child charge. And so this case will now go back to the trial court for resentencing. There was another criminal law case that was approved for publication, which was State versus Gormand. And in that case, again, appellate division, the defendant appealed from the denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea to second-degree theft by deception. And then at his plea, the defendant admitted to accepting money from an individual for whom he was to purchase sporting event tickets. However, on appeal, the defendant argued that the trial court erred in denying his motion to withdraw his guilty plea because his plea colloquy, meaning the what goes on in court, because in a trial court, when a defendant pleads guilty, there has to be a colloquy, that meaning that they have to talk about what they did, not just say, I did it. So there has to be something that the trial judge can impose and take the plea, in other words, and impose whatever punishment there is going to be. But a trial judge can't just accept the guilty plea without more. So at that point, as I said, on appeal, the defendant argued that the trial court erred in denying his motion to withdraw his guilty plea because his plea colloquy did not establish a factual basis to find that he was guilty of second-degree theft by deception. And the appellate division agreed and reversed, finding that contrary to the allegation that defendant misled the victims into believing he had tickets, the defendant stated during his plea colloquy that he did not know that he would not be able to obtain tickets until he had collected money from the victims, and that he intended to return the money to the victims. Thus, the appellate court ruled that the defendant's colloquy failed to establish that he knew he could not provide the tickets when he was taking the money, or that the victims relied on any deception when they gave the defendant their money. The court further rejected the trial court's application of the statute in denying defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea, ruling that the statute was only applicable to trials since the statute explicitly referenced trial procedures that are inapplicable in a police situation. So I don't know the specifics of this and what the tickets were, but certainly, that's one of the concerns when those of us who are sports fans buy tickets when they're just promised that they're going to show up. There is another, it's not unusual that there are a lot of criminal appeals. Very often they can be done either by jailhouse lawyers or everyone is entitled to appeal, but usually the cost for private defendants is too much, and yet it's easier for criminal defendants to appeal. So the next one is State versus Presley, and in that case, the defendant appealed from the appellate division's order affirming his conviction. Now, this case was actually a Supreme Court. This went up to the Supreme Court. So the defendant appealed from the appellate division's order affirming his conviction for possession and distribution of cocaine within 1,000 feet of a school. And there are enhanced penalties when there's distribution within 1,000 feet of a school. And, of course, we know in some communities it's almost impossible to be farther away than 1,000 feet. I remember years ago there was a case in Morris County where the charge, it was a distribution, as I recall, it was in a bar. The bar was within 1,000 feet of the school, and, of course, the sale took place at, you know, midnight or 1 in the morning. And I recall that Judge Stanton, who was a very conservative judge, good judge, by the book, he found that the defendant was not guilty within 1,000 feet of the school, because the school, even it was in a bar, that wasn't the concern as much of the fact of, you know, there were no school children that were possibly around at the time, because it was, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning when the sale was made. Now, he was overturned on appeal because of the strict letter of the law, said nothing about the time. It was just if there was any sale within 1,000 feet of a school at any time of day or night. So in any event, at the trial in this particular case that I'm talking about, the state presented evidence that the defendant sold cocaine to an undercover detective. At the end of the exchange, the defendant gave the detective his phone number. So the detective relayed the defendant's description to her supervisor, while a second observing detective monitored the defendant's movement. Now, several blocks from where the transaction took place, a third officer stopped the defendant. Upon recognizing the defendant, the officer released the defendant to protect the ongoing undercover operation. So the third officer returned to the police station and printed a photo of the defendant, the undercover detective identified the defendant as the individual who had sold the cocaine. And then following his conviction, the defendant argued to the appellate division that the trial court erred in not holding a pretrial hearing to determine the reliability of the detective's identification. And the defendant further argued that the prosecutor committed misconduct during her summation. And on appeal, the court affirmed, ruling that the record was insufficient to determine whether heightened protection should have been applied to the detective's identification. The court noted that there was no case law evaluating studies cited by the defendant that concluded police officers were not more accurate eyewitnesses than civilians. And we all know, or we should know, people should know, that eyewitness identification is often flawed, especially if the person identified is not of the same race as the person who's doing the identification. The court noted that there was no case law in this case evaluating studies cited by the defendant that concluded police officers were not more accurate eyewitnesses than civilians, or studies that cited by the state indicating a remote risk of undue suggestiveness with trained law enforcement officers. So it's a real esoteric case, but Justice Alvin entered that the court should have held that even police officers, where practical, be subject to a photo array for identification purposes. So this is, as I said, interesting case that came down from the Supreme Court that will certainly be used in future cases when there is identification. That is the real concern always, as to whether someone picks out the perpetrator in a lineup or from a photo, and certainly they have to be very careful in lineups so that the only person that's the defendant looks so different from everyone else in the lineup. So three criminal cases. And we'll be back right after I'll be back right after a brief note from a couple of our sponsors.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, Para Planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Okay, we're back. The program, It's the Law. I'm Pat Smits, your host. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the constitutional law issue in the case. I briefly started with that. But this is an interesting case because the issue was whether or not there was a violation of the New Jersey Constitution. And this case was 64 pages long, if you want to read it. And I'm sure that many people probably should, because I can see there's maybe misunderstanding of why this was the grant of $4.6 million was unconstitutional. In any event, the case, it was approved for publication on April 18th, and it was Freedom from Religion Found versus Morris County Board of Chosen Freeholders. And as I said, it was the author of the case was Justice Ravner, Chief Justice Ravner. So in this case, this group, Freedom from Religion Found, that's the name of the organization, they appealed from the trial court's grant of summary judgment to the defendants and denial of their cross motion for summary judgment in their complaint alleging that the defendant's grant program violated the religious aid clause of the New Jersey Constitution. So the Morris County Board of Chosen Freeholders allows and makes grants, and of course they're using taxpayers' money to do that. Summary judgment, as I've explained before, means that a trial court in this case, dismissed the plaintiff's case before any trial, just based on the papers. So in this case, what was underlying it is that the Morris County Board of Freeholders established a program to distribute historic preservation funding to four kinds of entities so that the many counties do have such grants available, and they're important for historic preservation. But in Morris County, the entities included religious institutions. So in the three-year period, 2012 to 2015, the freeholders approved 41.7% of grant funds to 12 churches for the restoration of church buildings, parish houses, and other items. And all 12 churches were Christian churches with active congregations. I think that the issue here is not that they were Christian churches, but that they had active congregations and conducted regular worship services in the structures in which the grant funds were used. And several applicants stated that the grant funds were necessary for the church to offer religious services. So that's the real problem here. It's not that it was an old historic church that was about to fall down and a historical society wanted to preserve it. These were active congregations conducting regular worship services, and in fact, some of the funds, they said, were necessary for the church to offer religious services. So in this case, the plaintiffs, the Freedom From Religion found, they filed the present lawsuit, and the trial court granted summary judgment to the Morris County Board of Freeholders. And then on appeal, the appellate division reversed, ruling that the grant program ran afoul of the religious aid clause. And the religious aid clause in the Constitution prohibits requiring any person to pay taxes for building or repairing any place of worship or for the maintenance of any ministry. So although the court noted the outstanding question of whether a qualified religious entity could be denied public funds simply due to its religious character, it held, in this case, the defendant's program violated the religious aid clause because the religious recipients intended to and did use their funds for religious uses. That's a quote, religious uses. So the court held that the anti-establishment purpose of the religious aid clause did not attend any animus towards any religion, and however, and further held that the religious aid clause did not violate the free exercise clause of the federal constitution. The court noted that grants from the Morris County Freeholders Program would still be evaluated under the establishment clause. And then in a concurring opinion, Justice Solomon argued that the religious aid clause could not bar religious organizations from receiving public funds for a categorically governmental purpose without violating the free exercise clause. So that still, I guess, would still be a possible issue if, in fact, the funds were granted for some governmental purpose. Off the top of my head, I can't think of one, but perhaps if it was a daycare center, that might be the possible exception. Had nothing to do with religion. There was no religion taught. Could be some other, homeless shelter, for example. And if they received, it was a historic church, and they received funds to bring the church up to regulations in order to house the homeless. I mean, I can think of a number of other reasons that there might not be the same decision, but certainly in this case, they were active churches, and the people who were being benefited were the parishioners of that church. So that would be, significant, good decision. Has nothing to do with against any religion, but in fact, it is saying that people shouldn't have to pay taxpayer money in that for that basis. So the What else is happening? Well, there's a newsletter for students on diversity issues, spring 2018 issue of Respect. That tackle those issues and would be certainly worth reading. And the latest issue has articles on religious freedom, free speech, and the Native American concept of seven-generation stewardship. So it should be interesting for anybody like my husband who would be interested in that. There's a division motor vehicle case, tort case, which was, this is again a New Jersey Supreme Court, and the plaintiff in that case appealed from the appellate division's order affirming the jury verdict, finding that the defendant and a John Doe defendant negligent for motor vehicle accident and apportioning the fault between them. So in this case, the defendant's car was behind the plaintiff's vehicle with both making left turns when another vehicle to the right of both cars unexpectedly cut off the left turn lane. And I guess we can all, you know, envision that. And then although the plaintiff was able to stop his vehicle, the defendant rear-ended plaintiff's vehicle. So, of course, in this case, the plaintiff obviously stopped quickly. And so always the issue is rear-end accident, always the person who hits you or you hit is going to be liable. So in this case, the plaintiff suffered serious injuries and filed an uninsured motorist claim with his insurer. Plaintiff also sued the defendant and the driver of the other vehicle, who was named a John Doe. Was obviously didn't stop. They didn't know who it was. So the defendant asserted third-party negligence as a defense. So that means the defendant in this case was the guy who hit the other guy. And that was third-party negligent as a defense and cross-claimed for indemnity and contribution from any co-defendants. So at the trial, the court concluded that he included the John Doe on the verdict sheet over plaintiff's objection and instructed the jury to apportion fault between the defendant, i.e., the guy who hit, rear-ended the other man, and John Doe if the jury found both negligent. So in this case, the jury returned a verdict finding the defendant 3% negligent and John Doe 97% negligent. Now remember, the John Doe, they never found, and the defendant hit the plaintiff because the plaintiff had to stop short because this other vehicle unexpectedly cut off the left turn lane. So in this case, the plaintiff was saying, wait a minute, there's only 3% as far as from the defendant, and I have no idea who the John Doe is. So after that, the appellate division affirmed the jury decision, ruling that the alleged tortfeasor, meaning the person who created the accident or caused the accident, I should say, does not need to be an identified party for his or her negligence to be determined by the jury. And then on appeal, then, the appellate division affirmed, first noting that the Comparative Negligence Act, that's what we have in New Jersey, in other words, you compare the negligence because both parties, you know, may be negligent. Ordinarily, it would be the plaintiff and the defendant. But in this case, it was the plaintiff, it was the defendant and the third party John Doe that we never found out who that was. But in on appeal, then, the appellate division affirmed, first noting that the Contributive Negligence Act and the Joint Tortfeasors Contribution Act require juries to allocate, excuse me, not speaking well today, these laws require juries to allocate negligence among tortfeasors based on the evidence, including those tortfeasors who settled if the plaintiff had noticed. And so what you can often have is one person may settle, one defendant may settle, and so they're out of it, and they take the risk of either being more or less liable, but they've settled for a certain amount of money. Usually it's their insurance companies. So the court also noted that plaintiffs could sue John Doe's, whose identities were unknown, and found that judgments apportioning liability to John Doe's had been affirmed. The court noted that the jury in this case could apportion fault between the defendant and John Doe because the parties had acknowledged John Doe's role in the accident. And the plaintiff's insurer was aware of the litigation, and the plaintiff had noticed the defendant was asserting that John Doe was the cause of the accident. So this, as I said, this was an appeal from the appellate division, and the Supreme Court found that plaintiffs can sue John Doe's, even though their identities are unknown, and also found that judgments apportioning liability to John Doe's have been confirmed. And they ruled that the jury in this case could apportion fault between the defendant and the John Doe because both parties, the plaintiff and the defendant, had acknowledged John Doe's role in the accident. They also noted that the plaintiff's insurer was aware of the litigation and that plaintiff had noticed that the defendant was asserting John Doe was the cause of the accident. Unusual, interesting case with respect to the fact that the liability of the defendant was really minimal, and it's probably the defendant's insurance company, obviously, that was whatever the situation was, they're not going to have to pay much if it's only 3%. There are a number of family law cases that were not approved for publication, which only means that they could be very interesting, but not something that is going to be approved for publication. Usually that means they think that they're too specific. Well, let me take a break, short break, and bring you some more spots from our sponsors, and then I'll be back to finish the program.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you...
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, I'm back and... Maybe time to talk about one more case that I find of real interest because I practice in Warren County. And the Warren County Court building, kind of beautiful building from the outside, but truly inadequate. And what they did is there was a the court renovated, quote-unquote, renovated a courtroom. And it's woefully inadequate. And so what happened in this case, and this is, as I said, this is an appellate division case, and it's In Re Vicinage 13 of the New Jersey Superior Court. And Hunterdon County, Warren County, and Somerset County are Vicinage 13. Frankly, as an attorney who now practices in this county, practiced for many years in Morris County, but I don't think Hunterdon County is being well served, or Warren County being well served by the fact that they're included in a vicinage with Somerset County. Very, very different. And of course, the question always is, are we getting the assigned judges that we should have? And they move around, et cetera, et cetera. But in any event, this is a case of should be of interest to a lot of attorneys, not just criminal attorneys. So what happened is that the Office of the Public Defender, the OPD, appealed from a declaratory judgment ruling that courtroom number 2 in the Warren County Courthouse was constitutionally adequate for criminal jury trials. Frankly, I don't think they've been having any in that courtroom because they always stick the family court in there. And it's really just not even adequate for any trial. But in any event, that's my opinion. In this case, the action began when the public defender objected to holding a criminal trial in the newly renovated courtroom number 2, in part because they've got a couple pillars that you really can't see around. So that was the objection. But the objection was overruled, and the trial proceeded to conclusion. And then a second criminal trial was scheduled to be held in courtroom number 2, but the trial judge granted a motion to move the trial to another courtroom. And the trial judge, who at least all of us attorneys know and applaud her from doing it. And I think this is when I say her, I believe I know who actually made that decision in that second trial. But in any event, the judge ruled that the design features, such as obstructions of the defendant's view of the witness stand and the jury box, rendered courtroom number 2 constitutionally inadequate. Now, the prosecutor's office and the public defender's office agreed to renovations of the courtroom. Thereafter, Warren County moved for the present declaratory judgment. So, in other words, both the prosecutor and the defender's offices, they agreed that this was just an inadequate, quote-unquote, renovation. Now, the trial court had ruled that the another judge, but the trial court ruled that the Office of the Public Defender lacked standing because it was not representing an individual whose trial was scheduled for courtroom number 2. And the trial court also ruled, now this is in the second, case. So when Warren County moved for the present declaratory judgment, before the trial court ruled that the public defender's office lacked standing to be involved because it was not representing an individual whose trial was scheduled for courtroom number 2. The trial court also ruled that renovations to the courtroom resolved the constitutional deficiencies previously identified by another trial judge. However, the public defender's office argued in this case that renovations failed to correct line-of-sight issues or provide space necessary for a criminal trial or increase available seats in the courtroom. And then on appeal, the appellate division reversed the declaratory judgment and remanded for further hearing on whether courtroom number 2 passed constitutional muster, ruling that the public defender in fact had standing and should have been allowed to participate in the declaratory judgment. They should have been allowed to participate in that proceeding. The appellate division ruled that the subject matter of the action implicated interest of indigent criminal defendants, and that's who the Office of Public Defender represents. And it's so that to the extent that the matter could not be addressed without the public defender's participation, because otherwise if the prosecutor said fine, who was going to object? So in any event, the court further held that the matter was I can never say the word, so I won't. So that, in fact, Warren County and the public defendant, the public defender's office, sufficiently disagreed over the effect of the renovations and had different priorities. So this, this is ongoing, and Warren County, anyone who goes into that courtroom, you don't have to be an architect or an attorney to see how difficult it is to try any case, even without a jury. And so it, it makes it very difficult to, it's just not a courtroom that we should have, certainly out in Warren County or anywhere else in the state. So that, that was that case, and so what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot more money spent, and of course many people, including attorneys, feel that Warren County should, just have a new courthouse, and they needed the extra courtroom, and they have some beautiful old courtrooms, don't get me wrong. The courtroom where they're holding criminal trials now, or at least recently, the last time I was in that courtroom where they were holding criminal trials, was a beautiful old courtroom. It's just this new renovated courtroom, and it wasn't a courtroom. They took, I don't remember what was there before. I think there were some offices there. So there's not the same objection to all the courtrooms in Bergen County, in Warren County, but certainly that one is, and hopefully they'll do something, interesting case. Interesting case about an ex-woman police officer in Bellevue Police Department who attributed her collapse while on duty to discrimination-related stress, agreed to a $1.1 million settlement of her Essex County suit this past week. And I think there's going to be more of these. And, of course, suits like that often depend really where the suit is brought. There are, as I said, there were a number of cases that are interesting to me as a family lawyer, but were not published. Because there was one, for example, that's not published, and the court determined that an LLC was created to conceal the transfer of assets and to deprive the plaintiff of alimony. And the court agreed with the defendant and reversed and remanded the issues that the trial court had no authority because in that case the trial court appointed a receiver for the LLC. Even though it was not published, it would certainly be of interest in matrimonial cases because in this case, the appellate division said that the trial court should not have entered an order denying the LLC's request to intervene because the plaintiff failed to provide notice to the LLC and two of its members. So the and also the defendant's claim, which sought a retroactive alimony modification, was not considered by the court because the defendant failed to argue that any provision of the alimony statute pertained to him. So this was, as I said, an appellate division case, Settinari versus Settinari. So all the family lawyers will be reading it, and certainly if it'll be of interest to anyone where there an issue of whether or not one party transfers money into either LLCs or any other place. So we'll be back with the next program, which it's finished with It's the Law, and we'll come back with the sports guys shortly after the news and some things from our sponsors. Okay? Hope to see you next week and bring you more law news. I am going to, bring an attorney on to talk about franchises. And also I'd like to get somebody from the prosecutor's office. Certainly there's a lot going on with the opioid crisis and other matters that I think they could really help give a lot more information to the public. So see you next week.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News.
Wells Fargo will pay $1 billion to federal regulators to settle charges tied to its mortgage and auto lending business. In the settlement announced today, Wells will pay $500 million to the Office of Comptroller of Currency and $500 million to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Some folks have scoffed that the $1 billion fine is not enough. Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney says, not so fast.
I don't think the folks at Wells think $1 billion is a small amount of money. I don't think anybody should think that $1 billion is a small amount of money. So this is a historically large collection, and we're very satisfied with the outcome.
Republicans are moving away from their call to repeal the Affordable Care Act as a midterm election approach. That's according to The Hill. Despite campaigning heavily on a plan to repeal and replace Obamacare, Republicans couldn't pass their bill, giving Democrats a chance to attack the GOP for failing to follow through on one of their promises. This is USA Radio News.
Ryan! I don't know how else to say this, so I'll just say it.
What is it, Linda?
I think we should see other people.
Are you breaking up with me on a roller coaster?
Well, we do have a lot of fun. Maybe we should stay together.
An emotional roller coaster? Surprising. What's not surprising? how much you could save by switching to GEICO.
I just need a little me time.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Shaquille O'Neal here. If you battle back or hip pain or knee or shoulder pain, you don't have to tough it out. You can just turn it off with Smart Relief from Icy Hot. You just push a button and whoosh. Smart Relief sends waves of relaxing pulses that safely block pain at the nerve level. It's simple, easy to use, and it's been clinically tested to start providing immediate relief for hours, even after you turn it off. So if you're battling pain, let Icy Hot help you win that battle. Turn on Smart Relief and turn off pain.